What's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fans, or the armchair quarterbacks. We got some draft news that we're going to talk about today, which is why I intro'd the show that way. But as always, I'm King Kaz, joined by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great JVZ.
Good to be here, Kaz.
I'm happy it's draft time. We get to talk about things that our teams aren't going to pick.
It's definitely one of those times to be optimistic, even though I think sometimes our teams in different sports have tendencies to really mess up the draft. So it's also time to be pessimistic, but or maybe cynically optimistic is the way I should put it.
I think of all armchair coach, armchair quarterback kind of things, the NFL draft brings it out the most in like the fly-by-night sports fan like thing, which is kind of why I'm so excited about it, right? This is like one of those like water cooler office kind of style things that people spend way too much time talking about and have not enough knowledge of.
Yeah. And the thing is, you can do that because nobody else has spent time looking into this either, so nobody can call you out on your bullshit.
All right, but we're gonna start.
People have dived that deep into college football or college basketball or in the case of basketball, like, you know, EuroLeague basketball. To actually be able to identify like one talent from another, and most people have. Don't even know who these people are, and
they'll know a name or two, but other than that, it's tragic,
and they haven't heard that name before a month ago.
All right, but let's start with the roundup for today. What's our first story in the roundup?
Patrick Marleau, San Jose Sharks longtime veteran, and you know, minus a short stint elsewhere. Mm-hmm. He just tied Gordie Howe's mark of 1,767 NHL games played, and he's about to break that record in the next game. So I think these consecutive games played, but just most games played type records in heavy contact sports like hockey are especially impressive. So I think Patrick Marleau is one of those mythical figures in San Jose Sharks legend. Mm-hmm. I think he's been with the team for, I think, most of their entire existence, at least, being a local team in my area. I think for as long as I've known of hockey's existence in the San Jose area, which is kind of a weird thing on its own. Patrick Marleau has been a figure in Sharks history. He's been playing for as long as I've known hockey has existed. So this is kind of a special personal thing for me. And just being a captain of the team for a long time and just being a long time figurehead of the team. So it's great to see him. I mean, it's great to see him still playing. It sucked when he left the team a couple years ago, and it's great to see him come back and great to see him achieve this record with the team. So,
yeah, the Iron Man stat in sports is always kind of one of those like, Not necessarily weird in a bad way, but like weird ones, because you don't realize how much of an accomplishment that is until it happens, right? Because then it starts to dawn on you how tough some of these sports are on your body, like you said, and especially in contact sports like hockey or football or even soccer. How much that really, really, really means something to be able to play to a certain consistent basis that many games and play them to the fullest ability, right? It's not always guys who have like the greatest stat lines or things like that, but they're usually guys who are in there doing things, and especially in a sport like hockey where everybody is kind of keeping busy doing something. That's a real big accomplishment.
Yeah. I think technically the term Iron Man is reserved for consecutive games played. But I don't like that stat as much just because it kind of emphasizes playing through injuries. I like the just in general most games played because it emphasizes longevity and keeping your body healthy and being able to maintain a career as you get older. So Patrick Marleau is 41 years old right now. So that's not a record as far as oldest players to ever play in the NHL, but still just a testament to how well he's taken care of himself and how long he's been able to play at such a high level. If you're curious, for the NFL, Jerry Rice has the equivalent stat when it comes to non-kickers at 303 games. Brett Favre is at 302 games. So, both of those guys played until they were 40. So Tom Brady is probably on the way there. Actually, he's two games behind that. He's at 301, so he'll probably break that next year.
All right. Got a little bit of actual boxing news. We'll preference it like that.
or gatekeeping. Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury are set for the heavyweight unification bout for boxing. And I think this has been a long anticipated fight. And I think ever since Tyson Fury knocked out Deontay Wilder last year, I think everybody's been trying to make this particular fight happen.
So this is, I want to talk more on the sense of like the brand confusion that happens in soccer. Boxing sometimes.
Yeah. Between the different title belts. I
know who both of these boxers are, right? I know that they're both really, really, really good and at the top of their games right now. The thing I tend to forget to realize, which is the brand confusion, is that they even compete in the same sport until this happens, until they fight each other, right? It's a very extreme saying of that, but I just mean, like, I know who Tyson Fury is. I've seen the highlights. I've seen some of his matches. I know who Anthony Joshua is. He kind of got me back into paying attention to boxing. But it's that sense where, like, more so, I forget they're both heavyweights, or I forget that just that boxing isn't, like unified in this sense, right? They didn't have to fight each other, but it makes for a good card that they do. But it takes so long for these things to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we've been kind of just waiting for this to happen for a couple years, even though it's like the next obvious step. But like, these two guys are just going to spend a couple years posturing. And obviously, like, COVID kind of threw a wrench into it in between. But it sucks that everybody's wanted this fight for a couple of years. It's the obvious next step to unify all these title belts, and just it takes this long for these kinds of fights to happen just because of all the negotiation and all the posturing that happens, and because there's no single entity that actually controls all of this. So it's just a matter of two camps negotiating with each other. And and then on top of that, it's, trying to pick a venue to try to maximize the amount of money that comes in. And so that's the news now, is that both fighters have agreed on a venue, which is reportedly in Saudi Arabia for a fight that, for a sport washed fight that is going to generate, upwards of $200 million.
The thing, right? Like, and then there are still these things that have to be negotiated and talked about. And like, one of those things, one of the camps could wildly take out of control, and then this fight doesn't happen.
Yeah. So not heavyweights, but like, you know, the Floyd Mayweather Manny Pacquiao fight happened like 5 years too late. Mm-hmm. And you know, during that time there were all kinds of fights over, like little mini spats over, you know, things like the weight of the gloves that they were going to use and the method of drug testing that they were going to use. And, and so all these little things that still have to, these little details that still have to happen, but at least for now, it looks like we're on the right path. And so it's boxing needs its heavyweight division and it sucks that, it's taken so long. It's almost been like it's since the Klitschkos and even before then, like, you know, Lennox Lewis before that, where a lot of sports fans actually had their eyes on the heavyweight division in boxing. So at least hopefully these two can put on a good show. And I feel like Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder a couple of years ago, at least the hype surrounding that was, felt like the hype around the heavyweight division when I was a kid. It's not quite the same as the circus that surrounds Mike Tyson, but
yeah, like Mike Tyson, Holyfield, people like that, and that's what you're talking about. I that's what I wish we could kind of get back to, right? I feel like those fights in that time period actually happened in a manner that seemed reasonable, I guess is the best way I could describe it, right? Like this guy was doing really well. Okay, they gotta fight each
they're
other
on a collision course.
Boom, it happened. Whereas now I feel like it's so like nickel and dime. It's so like little tit for tat. And like as soon as somebody says something weird on Twitter, fights off, like can't happen now because he said, you know, he thinks blue is blue and I think blue is green. And now just because of that, we are not going to fight. So blame him, you know, and it becomes stuff like that I think is annoying. Whereas something like the MMA, fights happen pretty much on time and sometimes even to a fighter's detriment.
Yeah. So on that note, Clarissa Shields is making the transition from boxing to MMA, and she's pretty much conquered her weight division and several other weight classes as well.
Yeah.
In the boxing realm. So and she's only 26 years old, so I think Holly Holm is probably definitely one of the hallmarks of making that transition. And she did it at 29 years old. Mm-hmm. So, Shields is 26 and 11-0 in boxing, two-time gold medalist, unified all the light middleweight titles, or at least the major ones. And so it's almost, she doesn't intend to stop boxing, but it's almost like she needs another challenge.
Yeah. I mean, this is a person who has, you know, won world championships and Olympic championships in their class. So I think it is that. I think it's looking for something to challenge you, right? Because you feel like you've kind of dominated the space that you're in. And there's literally no higher peak to reach, so you need a new mountain to climb.
Yeah, or at least something to do while you wait for challengers in your current sport. June 10th is when she'll be making her debut, and that fight will be on ESPN2. So it'll be good to see that on national TV. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I haven't been able to check out any of her boxing matches. So this will be my first chance to get a good look at her in any fighting realm. So everybody check that out, because we've been talking about how Amanda Nunes has kind of done the same thing when it comes to MMA. So any potential challengers we're looking for, but like she's looking for any potential challengers on the boxing side.
But remember, this is the thing that we said when we did talk about it, right? We said at some point, you have to start looking outside of the MMA circles to bring other people in, right? So, and that's what Dana White and the UFC are really good at, right? They're really good at looking at other potential athletes in different fighting disciplines and bringing them in. Now, the thing is, sometimes they don't let those people get up to speed enough, right? They oversell the hype, right? Oh, we got this crossover person. They'll give them one or two fights or whatever to make them look really dominant, and then they put them up against their really dominant MMA fighter, and then they look like a clown. Because you end up coming across this person who has really good cross discipline. Now, obviously, this person is a world-class fighter, right? That is literally on her resume, that she is a world-class fighter. And I think this is the better version of that, possibly. But I still would rather them give her some time to acclimate to fighting in the cage and that style of fighting before you oversell the hype of Clarissa Shields versus Nunes.
Yeah, and I think we're the ones that are kind of getting ahead of ourselves with that. I'm just trying to draw parallels because at the very least, this this is not with the UFC. This is with the Professional Fighters League. So, come on. Yeah, like we're looking a couple years down.
Very many times before, right? Like, I guess we act like there isn't any other trajectory in MMA except for the UFC.
So at the risk of overlooking her opponent, Brittany Elkin, we're looking a couple years down the line, but hopefully she has a successful debut and doesn't, you know, flame out on her first match. But I think she'll have to prove herself with the PFL for a couple matches, and then maybe she'll get the call up to, or I say that like they're affiliated, but maybe then she will be able to sign with the UFC and get a contract. And she's, like I said, she's a couple years ahead of the route that Holly Holm took. She got to the pinnacle of the division and knocked out the head of the division at the time when she kicked Ronda Rousey in the face. So who knows? We might be watching the start of a brand new career here. All right. Speaking of young fighters or young athletes looking to make names for themselves, we got the NFL draft coming up. Not this coming Thursday, but the Thursday after that, April 29th. So the first round that day, and then second and third rounds the next day, I believe, and then the rest on the Saturday after. So I think the first two picks are pretty much seem to be set in stone. At least there's not a whole lot of talk around those, just because I think everybody assumes that Trevor Lawrence is going number one. That's to the Jacksonville Jaguars, and Zach Wilson is going number two to the New York Jets. So we talked about the trade a couple of weeks ago with the 49ers trading up to number three, and there's still a lot of smoke around who they are going to pick at number three, whether it's going to be Justin Fields or whether it's going to be Mac Jones or Trey Lance. I think for some reason the media narrative keeps trying to push Mac Jones at number three, and I think it's this weird thing where everybody thinks that the 49ers coach Kyle Shanahan has a type at quarterback. And so, like, Mac Jones seems to fit that type, and that's like guys who are not that mobile. I guess maybe the Kirk Cousins type, the Jimmy Garoppolo type. I think And I think that's just looking too much into it, because at the end of the day, I think what matters the most is talent, and mobility is an important part of playing in the NFL today. And to me, the idea that Kyle Shanahan does not know how to coach a mobile quarterback, or I think that's what some of those comments are kind of implying, and I just don't think that that's true. So I really hope, it seems to me, and again, like as we mentioned at the top of the show, we are pretending like we're experts here, but I think Justin Fields is kind of the obvious choice at this point, and everything else is just kind of trying to take like small things that we see when it comes to evaluating Trey Lance, or small things when it comes to evaluating Mac Jones, and trying to inflate them into bigger things. Whereas the 49ers, it seems like they traded up to this spot because they knew they wanted one of those three guys, and they didn't want other teams making that decision for them. They wanted to be able to just adequately take a look at all three of these guys and evaluate them all against each other and pick from the best of the three. And I think if you do that, I think Justin Fields is kind of the obvious choice. And I don't care about what anybody says about don't take Ohio State quarterbacks, because, you know, all those trends of like, okay, there's never been that good of an Ohio State quarterback to actually make it in the NFL. Those were all previous coaching regimes in Ohio State. And every time they get a new coach and they get a new system in, then you have to reset the count on that. So I don't know. I think it's the obvious choice. It's certainly going to be a quarterback, because you don't give up as much as the 49ers did to move up. I think it was like 9 spots to not take somebody at quarterback. But also, whoever they do take doesn't have to come in and start right away, because they do still have Jimmy Garoppolo on the roster, and they've committed to, or at least they publicly committed to him playing out the season with the 49ers. I do think it's at least at the backup quarterback level, this is a glaring team need for the 49ers, because Garoppolo went down last year and he spent about half of his time here so far injured. So, you know, backup quarterback is a pretty serious need for the 49ers, and in this case it will be the quarterback of the future, so it's very, very important that they get this pick right. It's very, very important that they don't overthink it and just evaluate based on the merits of everybody's skills and how well you think they're going to translate, and not try to reach, because you don't have to reach. You have your pick of three pretty good quarterbacks and a pretty good coaching staff to be able to coach up their talents. So yeah, I hope it's Justin Fields. I hope they don't try to do anything too fancy. I think anybody who's out there who tries to say that the pick is Mac Jones and it's like they have some sort of insider info is bullshitting, just because the 49ers don't seem to leak anything. And I'm not saying that as like a fan of the team that doesn't want to believe. It's like this team surprises me all the time with moves that they kind of just suddenly make.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of rumors swirling around, as is the case with every team, but then, you know, stuff happens and it's like, oh shit, where were the rumors on that? Like I heard nothing about that happening, and all of a sudden it happened. So I trust the team to do its due diligence, and I trust the team to, I trust that, and like nobody actually knows what's going to happen, and that whatever they are thinking of doing, they haven't leaked it yet. So I almost think that like all these Mac Jones rumors are just maybe Mac Jones's agent trying to put out feelers out there and try to inflate his draft stock, and maybe get some other teams to try to trade up to take him a little bit earlier. But yeah, I think that's always something to be wary of. But so quarterback is definitely the pick at number three. The 49ers have a couple other picks at 43, 103, and a couple later ones. Apparently this is a very deep wide receiver draft, so hopefully they take advantage of that, because wide receivers, at least for the last couple of years, has been a pretty deep. Some of the guys that they've taken have not quite lived up to expectations. It's always good to add more talent there. And they lost Richard Sherman last year, or in this offseason. So I think adding some secondary depth is going to help. And they could always use some offensive line help, as can every team. So, but I think this is a better team than their record was last year. So I think for the most part, they just need to add depth, and they need to set it up so that when Jimmy Garoppolo inevitably gets injured, he has a competent backup replacing him and not the likes of Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard and other people that nobody really knows. So that's my 49ers report. Kaz, what do you think the Giants are going to do?
So, okay, here. So I did my due diligence. I went and I looked, and I kind of looked at stat lines and media hot takes and stuff like that. So the overall consensus is that what the Giants are going to look to do is either find value in their draft picks for positional players, or they're going to use their draft picks on positional players. They kind of, the overall thought is they're going to stick with Daniel Jones for at least two more years. They're going to see this experiment out at picking this kid and working him into their system and letting him be their quarterback of the future, while trying to find the pieces to fit around him, as opposed to finding a quarterback to fit around the pieces they already have, which I talked about in the past, them having a pretty good team. One of the big glaring omissions, I think, when you have a young quarterback, is protecting him, giving him that time to acclimate to the game. So one of the big things a lot of people are talking about is them getting a stronger offensive line, picking up some linemen to strengthen that core, to give him time to work in the pocket and make decisions. One of the other things is targets. I don't necessarily think any of the targets that he has on the Giants roster currently are that bad, but when people kind of want to get nitpicky, they kind of put more of the blame of a lot of his interceptions on bad routes, you know, on the call, or people missing catches. Evan Engram, who's the tight end, who's kind of their premier tight end, dropped a lot of passes this year. And a couple of those like missed passes are ones that went for interceptions. So people think maybe he becomes more of a distraction next year. Like he runs the route, but he's not going to be the guy you throw to, and you get another tight end who can actually catch, and Evan Engram becomes more of a pass blocker or a rush blocker in that sense. And then you get a wide receiver either through trade for that number 11 pick or in the draft. Cause like you said, this is a pretty stacked, other than the quarterbacks that are coming out of the top of the list, this is a pretty stacked wide receiver draft.
Yeah, so they did get Kenny Golladay in the offseason, so mm-hmm. I think DGM knows all about him, and so do anybody who was lucky enough to have him in fantasy last year. So So yeah, it looks like they are at least trying to do a good job of putting the pieces around Daniel Jones, and hopefully he kind of continues to progress. And I know he's kind of the butt of a lot of jokes because of how the Giants reached up to draft him, and in a way because of the way the Giants overthought it a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So
like I said in our pre-show, right, I think they reached and they tried to get their quarterback of the future, and they looked for an archetype, right? They looked for a Tom Brady-esque.
they got an Eli Manning clone.
They were looking for a Brady and they got another Eli. You know, and Eli progressed over time, and he kind of did become this guy. And I mean, the Giants are kind of known for mostly sticking with their quarterback. They don't really mix it up too much with their quarterbacks. So as much as I, and this is my wild fantasy, would love to see them make some moves, which would be very expensive for them, to get Russell Wilson, that's not going to happen. Right, because they would have to give up a lot of these pieces, a lot of these chess pieces that they put in place to work around Daniel Jones to get a player, and then have to do the thing where they struggle again to then get pieces to put in place. Right, no team wants to do that. You've already been through the struggle part. You're trying to get to the actual building of a foundation. So I think those are their immediate needs, right? Build an offensive line that can actually protect this kid in the pocket, give him a little bit more time to work through the progression, find the receivers he wants to hit. Because I think he threw something in the range of 10 or 11 interceptions this previous season, which is a lot for what is supposed to be an elite quarterback, right?
That's not too bad, I would say, but. Yeah, and I think unless you're saying like that, you know, those are the ones that did not hit his wide receiver's hands and end up in the arms of defenders. I don't think 10 is too bad. I think like the gunslinger types generally end up with somewhere around 15 or 20, and you know, there was that year that Jameis Winston got 30. I feel like 10's not too bad. Sometimes it's. It's the timing of the interceptions too, and sometimes there are, you know, just momentum killing interceptions, but I don't know if those are the types, just because I haven't watched the Giants play a lot.
If we really want to get super nitpicky, right? We want to get super nitpicky. That number is down over last year, right? Last year he throws 12 interceptions. This year he throws 10. The number's down, so we're trending in the right direction, right? But even overall, his stats got somewhat better, but also somewhat worse, because he got 24 touchdowns in 2019 and only 11 this season, but also had 12 fumbles in that 2019 season and only 8 in this season, right? So
that's a lot.
Yeah.
in both cases.
Yeah.
So
But he also got sacked a lot more, which is that thing, right? So if you look at it where the things you want to look at, right? Like, he's getting sacked a lot more. He threw a lot less interceptions even with that, but he also threw a lot less touchdowns. So you could put that on the offensive line, right? You can say, oh, he wasn't getting protected enough to be able to make those reads and those decisions that he's gotten better at making to be able to help him. So that's one of the things. The other thing is defense, which I'm still not that great on NFL defenses. I don't know what I'm looking at a lot of the times. I do think, in my mind, looking at the stats for the Giants, I do think they need better rushers, which I kind of agree with the media assessment on. They need better edge rushers, maybe just a defensive lineman in there. But I think they need to focus on their secondary and people to rush the quarterback.
Yeah, I think when it comes to like armchair analysis of team needs, you can never go wrong with beefing up your offensive line and your defensive line. Mm-hmm. I will always blame the offensive line before I blame the quarterback, because a quarterback cannot thrive in chaos unless you are Russell Wilson. But even he doesn't
want to do that anymore.
Yeah, even in that case, like, you need to give time for your quarterback to be able to make good decisions on the field, because no matter what happens else, like no matter how smart the quarterback is, there's only so many things that they can do if they are tackled within 3 seconds of snapping the ball. There's just that's the great equalizer. So if you can get people on defense to disrupt opposing quarterbacks, which is exactly what the Giants did to Tom Brady in two different Super Bowls, you can cover up for a lot of other holes on your team. And if on offense you give your quarterback enough time to throw, you can make mediocre quarterbacks look like great quarterbacks and bad quarterbacks look like mediocre quarterbacks, just by giving them a comfortable environment to play in. So those types of investments are always worth making. And I think a lot of teams recognize that. At least the ones that don't are very glaringly obvious, and they have their quarterbacks. Just those are the types of teams that they have quarterbacks that everybody thinks they suck, and then they go to another team and those quarterbacks are all of a sudden good in a new environment. It's usually because they didn't put a good offensive line around them. Do that first and then give them targets to throw to, wide receivers and other skill positions. Protect the court. Like, if you can sum up good NFL strategy, it's on offense, protect the quarterback; on defense, disrupt the quarterback. And I think the Giants are kind of in that middle phase of building where you want to see some substance now. It's been a couple years with Daniel Jones and a lot of other young players. So let's see them make the next step.
Yeah, and as much as I like initially came into this and I was gonna shit on Daniel Jones and the Giants' decision making, I understand it, right? Like you want to be the person who picks out the gem, right? You want to be that. You want to show that you have that foresight. You want to show how great your scouting is, and obviously, for a player that from their stat line should have went a lot lower in the draft than the pick that you picked them at, their first couple years are not going to look good. It's just not right. And I think they've already okayed themselves with that. It becomes this, right? It becomes the get them comfortable, do the things that make them comfortable, allow them to understand the game, allow them to transition, allow them to find their way without trying to rush it. But at the same time, trying to, get somewhere and look good.
Yeah. And even if he is not the guy, you still want to build the team around him so that if you do have to swap him out for somebody else, then, that next guy comes in into a comfortable environment where they can succeed. So, but he is the guy for now, and you got to act like he's the guy for now. And so, time to keep building. All right. So, here on the Lions list of team needs, DJM put a lot in all caps. Let's see, yeah. You got a draft pick at 7, and, so what do you think they're going to do there?
Right now at number 7, of course, the Lions are in the unique position of going through a complete teardown, rebuild, new head coach, new general manager, entirely new coaching staff. But I think at number 7, I get the impression that I've got two things going here. Normally, I'm of the mindset that if you have a top 10 pick, you're either looking for a quarterback or you're looking for a big dude on one of your lines. And I think Dan Campbell, in his taste for kneecaps, he is probably going to be looking for a big dude. I think that a lot of Lions fans have come to the understanding that at least right now, given that the Lions organization restructured Jared Goff's contract for the next 2 years, it is understood that at least for the upcoming season, Jared Goff is going to be the quarterback. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with it. Is he great? Probably not. But JVZ, you made a lot of really good points about the offensive line and what they can do with a quarterback, which is kind of why I know that if he's there at number 7, I am hoping that it's the offensive tackle from Oregon, Penei Sewell, who has been the consensus number 1 offensive lineman in the draft, with Rashawn Slater right behind him, who people are slating as kind of a top 10, top 15 prospect. So my ideal at 7 for the Lions is Penei Sewell or Rashawn Slater, one of the offensive linemen. Also, general manager Brad Holmes from the Rams seems to have been known, one, as being a guy who has a real knack for college scouting. He was the head of college scouting for the Rams, and also finding talent in the later rounds. The Lions have gotten lots of draft picks over the next couple of years, even though they only have a few right now in this draft. So I'm not ruling out the likelihood of them trading down. That I think that is in play. Now, a lot of Lions fans are probably going to see the likes of the Jamar Chase, Devontae Smith, Jalen Waddle, and see these super talented wide receivers that played at a high level in the SEC in college. One of them is a Heisman Trophy winner, and they might want to run in that direction. And I'm kind of really against that, because I think that if you're able to build an offensive line around Jared Goff, he can probably at least be decent. And you can see that, Jared Goff, he's only 26 years old. Maybe he's not completely trash. Maybe he's not. And if he's got an offensive line around him to protect him, give him a couple of seconds. If he has the running game that we think DeAndre Swift could be with Jamal Williams and Kerryon Johnson, if the running game is halfway okay, and my God, I'm definitely against the Lions drafting Kyle Pitts at tight end, because they already have a tight end that they drafted in the top 10 in TJ Hockenson, who has made a Pro Bowl. Please don't do that. That might actually cause Lions fans to storm Allen Park and storm the training facility. Please don't do that. I feel like they're definitely out of the quarterback sweepstakes, unless they just absolutely love Justin Fields or Trey Lance. I think that's really unlikely. I think that at least for this year and maybe next year, Jared Goff is the guy. In which case, fine, whatever. They protect him with a good offensive line, which the Lions mostly have in place, with Taylor Decker, Frank Ragnow, who made a Pro Bowl, Jonah Jackson, and putting Penei Sewell in there. They would have a pretty well-set offensive line that could either, one, protect Jared Goff and be a good offense altogether, or two, if the Lions were to draft a quarterback next year, that would be an offensive line that has played together and has some experience together, and that future quarterback, whomstever it might be, would have an offensive line to protect him. So I'm leaning towards offensive line only because nobody's really talking about Penn State linebacker Micah Parsons. The Lions defense was historically bad. And I think the general mindset with the defense is it's an entirely new coaching staff. They couldn't possibly be any worse. They have to be better because it will be an entirely different scheme. It will be an entirely different coaching staff. And it just could not be any worse. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Micah Parsons is in play. If the Lions draft Micah Parsons at 7 overall, cool. I'm cool with it because all signs point to him being that kind of star linebacker slash pass rusher. And hey, there's nothing wrong with having a guy that can get to the quarterback or stop the run. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm leaning towards Penei Sewell, offensive tackle out of Oregon. And then later on in the draft, you can find the skill players. The wide receiver class is deep. There are some running backs in there that you might be able to sneak a look at. There are some young safeties they could look at because the Lions' safety core is pretty, not old, but experienced. They've got the cornerbacks that they've drafted recently, Jeff Okuda, Amani Oruwariye, that are young and developing. So everything to me really points towards the offensive line. And then maybe the secondary. So it really feels like things couldn't get any worse. And why I said a lot, it just feels like we all know that the Lions are completely rebuilding. And starting with getting an offensive lineman is kind of a very smart, sound football decision. It's not a splash, sexy pick. It's not Jamar Chase. It's not Devontae Smith. But I think most people would see it as a smart decision rather than a superstar splash decision. So I would hope that they would go with the offensive line.
Specifically for the Fly By Night sports fans, offensive tackle, those are the two linemen at the ends of the line, the most important one being the one on the quarterback's blind side. So in Jared Goff's case, that would be the left tackle,
which is now held by Taylor Decker, who the Lions actually just signed to a long-term deal last year, because he's kind of been just in the range of top 7, top 8 left tackles in football. So he's okay. Pretty good at that position. The word got out recently that Penei Sewell has been practicing at left and right tackle. So
yeah,
in the possibility that he's drafted by a team that already has a left tackle in place, he's been practicing at both positions.
Yeah. So yeah, left tackle is one of those money positions on the offensive line, those really, really important ones, the kind of guys that you see number one go number one overall in the draft sometimes, because they have that really tough job of blocking the quarterback's blind side. And you have to be so reliable that the quarterback can turn his back to you and know that he's not going to get tackled from behind. But also on the opposite side, on the right tackle side, you know, it's still important because you don't want guys rushing the quarterback to their face either. So yeah, just the tackles are important because they're on the edges, and the edges are where
that is where usually the best defensive pass rushers are. The J.J. Watts is of the world, Jadeveon Clowney's of the world. Superstar defensive tackles that get to the quarterback and get all the sacks and are like the stars of the defense.
Yeah, they come around the outside because it's crowded up in the middle. And that's where the action is, and that's where the money goes. It's always, and even if you have good players there, it's always good to have depth because those are very physical positions to play, and players get injured. So, sometimes it takes one bad injury to a left tackle to throw the entire offensive line into chaos. So it, it's
And it's
always good to look for depth. There.
To Bob Quinn's credit, the one thing he did manage to do decently well was find depth at the offensive line. So maybe that is something the Lions can build on. If they can build a strong offensive line, maybe this rebuild won't be so bad.
All right. So, yeah, the NFL draft is in couple weeks now. We're doing it this week because we're probably not going to do a show next week. So Thursday, April 29th, look out for that, and look out for who your teams are going to pick. And we've got a link to the Ringer's draft coverage in our show notes if you want to dive deep into that. And I think they do a pretty good job, as well as plenty of other places around the internet as well. This is kind of the hallmark of the NFL offseason. So, like we said, it's the time where everybody gets to hope a little bit before the season comes around and everybody's and all the bad teams get their hopes dashed in week one when they see how bad their teams actually are. This is where you play the games on paper instead of having to play them for real. All right, let's move on to our next story. There's been a lot of talk recently around just a lot of anti-transgender bills around the country for various realms. But I think since this is a sports show, we're going to talk about it from the sports perspective because the Florida House of Representatives just recently passed a bill to block transgender athletes from playing on girls' sports teams. I think this particular bill is definitely on the. It's particularly insidious just because this was just a flat out blanket ban. There were several amendments attempted to try to, you know, tweak part of the bill a little bit, and all of them were rejected without explanation or debate. This was, like I said, it's just a flat out ban. On top of that, it created provisions where if any athletes' sex were to come into question, and first of all, not a whole lot of details around how that process were to take place, but basically any athletes whose sex comes into question, now they have to be subjected to a genital exam in order to prove that they are a girl so that they can play on a girls' sports team. So on top of the bill itself being hateful and having, like only 11 athletes in general, the Florida High School Sports Association, I believe that's what it's called, is like they actually have a process for transgender athletes to, for trans girls to register, so that they can play, and only 11 athletes have taken advantage of that to actually go through that process. So this bill itself is that's 11 people since 2013. So this bill is kind of something that's done in search of a problem that doesn't really exist. It's just this big hoopla over transgenderism, just because it's an easy target, certainly like a bad faith bill that's not really protecting anybody, and on top of that, this puts a lot of children in danger of abuse. Because like, I certainly don't trust parents to not try to abuse this particular policy to bully students. Like any girl athlete that has that shows like athletic prowess is potentially a target of this, not just transgender athletes. Youth sports can be pretty vicious, and the kind of things that that parents say on the sidelines to athletes, it's that can be vicious as well. And so I don't know, this is very
so this is one of those Band-Aid-esque situations for a problem that needed minor oversight. You know what I mean? Like you said,
I
right?
Mean, I don't there, even
there's
think
a, well, no. Like you said, there's a okay. Yeah, problem is a bad word. A situation that may have needed research and oversight. That's it, right? Yeah. Just four or five scientists to be like, you know what, here's the actual stat line of transgender athletes in, you know, crossing into to their assigned gendered sports, you know, as opposed to whatever. And just going from there, and maybe like a monitor of, I don't even know where to begin. There needs to be a person with a doctorate and scientific degree handling this, not a reactionary politician who wants to make sure their constituency votes for them, is what I'm trying to get to. There needs to be people who can do actual research and actual like scientific notation on these things, not like us as podcasters and not these people as politicians. There are people who know how to do these things, and it is not them. That's the number one thing. The number two thing is, like you said, all this does is breed a situation in which hate can grow. This just breeds a situation that puts, like you said, will put targets on children's backs who do not deserve them. It will breed situations of probably abuse in some circumstances, because you're giving a blanket pass for people to do things that they should not be doing, in a huge oversight in this. And it's just one of those things that like it should not be done this way. This is reactionary politics, and reactionary politics are always terrible. They're always terrible.
Yeah, it's very ugly, and I would encourage. I think we're not necessarily the right people to convey the research, but you know, we can try to do a quick summary. But I encourage everybody to go out there and actually do the research on this topic, because I think at a surface level, there's some very easy misconceptions that you can come to when you think of, you know, how boys and girls develop during puberty and how that might affect the athletic realm. But a lot of these trans girls transitioned earlier on in their life. They didn't go through male puberty. They didn't, everybody has, I shouldn't say everybody, but like the people that are making these bills either have it in their mind, or they're trying to exploit the fact that some people might have it in their mind that, these are, these are young boys out there that have gone through male puberty, and then they are switching to play in girls' sports so that they can dominate, and that's just not happening.
But let's also point out just as a obvious fact, this is like talking about in youth sports, right? This is talking about like high school level sports, where at most point people are starting to go through puberty, right? Like So if they are transitioning, then not only are they stopping their, you know, like what their body is going to do to then have it do something else. Like, you know what? There's just, once again, I need a person with a scientific doctor.
Well, so like basically,
there's just a lot
it
of
seems
shit.
Like the doctors have stated that trans girls play like girls. And so like this is not something you have to worry about, because there are no cases out there of a trans girl just dominating sports, because
yeah, but these people are going to cherry pick statistics. They're going to like nitpick everything.
They're not even, they don't even have statistics to cherry pick at this point. That's yeah. Like this is playing off of a fear that has little to no scientific basis at all. So it's just playing off of assumptions of how we think the body works. But it's, you know, like when you actually dive into the science around this, which is why I'm encouraging all of our listeners to do that. Like it's
the problem is
like
people,
some of those
actually
misconceptions just fall apart.
Yeah, but you know these people don't believe in science.
it's
you know these people don't believe in science.
I'm attributing a lot of this to malice, because like the way some of these bills are written are very malicious, and so I'm willing to bet that some of these people have read into it or refuse to read into it, because they know that when they do, they're going to be faced with truths that challenge their previous assumptions. And I mean, yeah, they're politicians. They do it this way so that they can exploit things for votes or exploit things for donations. And it's vicious. And this is going to have a very chilling effect on youth sports. This particular story is in Florida, but this is happening everywhere around the country. Mm-hmm. And it's this weird flashpoint.
I think a lot of it it started with collegiate athletes and some professional athletes, and it just kind of trickled its way down into youth sports, where the conversation shouldn't be happening at all anyway. But it's just one of those things. It's going to continue. It's going to like further. So I think the best thing we can tell everyone is what JVZ said, right? Look at the research, do your due diligence, read the actual documentation from people who know how to do research, and then have peer-reviewed research, not just anecdotal, but peer-reviewed research. And you know, make
your decision. Hold your politicians accountable.
Yeah, but yeah. So let's move on from this very heavy topic to something a little more fun. 21 batters, 21 strikeouts.
Yeah. Thank you to Reverend Buck for this story. But a North Texas softball pitcher, Hope Troutwin. This is the third time she's struck out 21 batters. These are 7-inning games, by the way, in NCAA Division I softball. She struck out 21 batters for the third time, but this is 21 batters, 21 outs, perfect game, no hits, no walks, just 21 up, 21 down. And this is the first perfect game in North Texas history, and I believe the only perfect strikeout game. Which is a tremendous accomplishment. Nobody even got the chance to put a ball in play at all. Yeah. It's just a completely dominant game. Like I said, this is the third time she struck out 21 batters in a win. And
it's one of those silly things. This in and of itself makes baseball or softball look boring, right? When a pitcher does their job so well, right? But it's so amazing if you know anything about baseball, man. Like, read, like, you know, like, because you're going up there, you're trying to read the pitch, you're going back, you're telling the next batter up, hey, what you saw, this is what I saw, this is what it looks like, boom, 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 so that they can try to come up there and dismantle the pitcher, right? It's a team effort versus this person, as well as that person's team trying to give you signals and things about what the batter thinks they see, all this kind of stuff. It's mind games at its highest level, is the pitcher versus the batter battle. But when the pitcher does it so well that they stump a whole team, right? And you got to realize, right, you get multiple chances to go up there and look at these pitches and try to figure out how to put it into play. And when you can't, that is amazing.
Yeah, it's not the most efficient outing, because, you know, you can get one pitch out, so you can do two pitch outs.
I think, but those ones
still
are more strategic, right?
Yeah,
those ones are more strategic, because there have been cases of those where teams do that because, you know, the person just wants to save their arm, and I think that takes a lot more strategy, right? Because you have to be able to read that this person is going to be able to put the ball into a position where you can still secure the out, right?
Yeah.
Whereas going up there and just dominating the batters is a lot more detrimental to your mental as the team trying to put ball into play, because you're just getting dominated, right? It's not a team playing around you. You are literally just getting decimated.
like 21 batters walked up to the plate and not a single one managed to put a ball in play.
Yeah.
That's got to be incredibly demoralizing. And
yeah,
it's, you know, it this is why strikeouts are still, like, it's just such a fun stat and a fun thing to watch in general. That pitcher batter matchup, I'm growing to appreciate that more, and trying to get away from my previous mindset about baseball being boring and, oh, this is just, you know, the pitcher and catcher playing catch with each other. As I learn more and more about it, and especially on the softball side too, because from what I've read, many batters, including like baseball batters, have said when they go up against softball pitchers are terrifying. And it's like, it's a little bit different. Like, it seems like on the baseball side, it's very strategic. But on the softball side, like you said, it's a matter of dominance and those softball pitches can kind of be deceiving. Like, you think, oh, like they're throwing underhand or whatever, but like when you actually see it for the first time, and when you're on the wrong end of it, when you're on the batter's end of it, and that ball is coming at you pretty quick from like down below, it's a different level of terrifying than a baseball pitch. And I don't think I'm doing that justice in describing it, but I, you know, from everybody, from all the baseball batters that I've talked about taking a softball pitch from like really high level softball players, it's a different kind of terrifying, this is a tremendous accomplishment. Trowin's a senior, so this is her final season with the team, but hopefully she can rack up a couple more spectacular outings this year. This is, like I said, her third 21 strikeout game. The actual record is 28, but those were in an 18 inning game and a 16 inning game in 2006 and 2004. I think for 9 inning games in Major League Baseball, like when we see a pitcher get to 10 strikeouts, that's an amazing game. Mm-hmm. So 21 is just kind of unheard of. It's just a completely unheard of level of dominance where batters are just swinging and swinging. Not anybody can get a hit at all. Congratulations to
I will say that that is kind of one thing I do miss about you know, fans and stands for like baseball games, especially like when people who enjoy baseball is when a pitcher is out there dominating people and you have the outfield like fans just putting up the K's. Like, yeah, those are fun. Those are always fun.
And it's not boring because like the tension keeps, like, especially in the case of a no hitter or a perfect game, like the tension keeps growing with every batter that comes up and gets put down. It's not a boring game of catch. It's just because no balls are being put into play. It is like the tension just increases every single time. And so it's very fun to watch. I encourage everybody, especially since the baseball season is going on now and softball as well. So if you are one of those people like me who used to talk about how boring those sports are, give it another shot. Check it out with a fresh set of eyes and learn to appreciate the art of pitching a little bit more. All right, that's our show for this week. Hit us up on Twitter throughout the week at Sports Odds Ends for the show Twitter account. And you can hit us up individually as well. I'm at JVZ, Kaz is at King Kaz, DJM is at Call Me DJM. SportsOddsAndEnds.com for our show notes this week. We've got links to all of our stories, and you can check out our past episodes there as well. We also got a link to the Discord there, so head on over there and we can all chat about sports throughout the week, share highlights. We can show clips of really awesome pitches that I like to put in there. it's also just random weird baseball plays. We've been doing a lot of that throughout the week as well. Twitch.tv/SportsOddsAndEnds is where you can listen to the show live when we record 2 p.m. on Sundays. And patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you want to support the show financially. So thank you to all of you who currently do that. And thank you to all of you who are listening every week. We will see you next time.